This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
They design offices for a lot of the tech companies and are very interested in making environments that attract the right type of talent.
We speak to the founder and CEO of Hem, a Stockholm-based furniture brand that's gone from startup to design world upstart in a few short years. And ahead...
One of the things that we're trying to do is to express that design is something of... you know, deep personal relevance to essentially everyone.
We're off to the UAE to see why the desert may yet prove fertile ground for cultivating talent. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Now, Swedish furniture maker Hem is one of the biggest design success stories to come from Scandinavia in recent years. Hem, the Swedish word for home, creates modern furniture and goodies from tables to sofas and carpets, with designers including Luca Nicetto, Pauline Dutour and Max Lam, to name but a few. Launched in 2014, it sells its ware online, but founder and CEO Petrus Palmer has recently secured a $5 million funding push in the US to expand his company. With a freshly opened pop-up space at London's Coal Drops Yard development, the man has a lot on his plate, but still found time to head to Midori House to catch up with Monocle's one and only design editor, Nolan Giles.
I think the inaccessibility of great product is one of the big issues with how the furniture industry has been set up. So you get watered-down versions of the best, which is a shame. I think more people should have access to a great product.
So in steps Hem, what did you do to fix this problem?
Well, when I decided to start Hem, it was in the one of... furniture online. It's gone quickly now, so now it's less of an innovation. But back then in 2013 and 14, it was still very rare to find brands that went direct and to produce products, furniture, sofas, etc., and so sell directly to customers. But it was happening in other industries. You could see it in fashion. You had a lot of American firms doing very well. And so we basically got inspired by that model and decided to produce our own furniture with all the elements that I treasured, quality and name designers that we thought were really interesting because of what they were doing, but then apply a new way of distributing the products online.
And the things you were talking about before, the tactile nature of furniture in terms of the metals, the woods, the fabrics, these are things that you sort of have to experience firsthand. You're delivering something that is available to see online, but maybe not to touch and feel. So how do you get that extra dimension over to your customers?
Yeah, that's a challenge. And we try our best with great imagery, with videos, with text. In the end, nothing beats the real experience. So that's why we're excited about the pop-up format, because it allows us to actually meet our customers and for them to touch and feel the product. So that component is needed. The people that buy from us without having seen the product trust us, which is very heartwarming that they actually trust us with a 3,000 euro sofa. But there's people that wouldn't, and we want to get to them as well, of course. So then the pop-up is an excellent format.
So how do you go about planning a pop-up? You know, you're a designer, you work with interior designers, you've got a great product at the heart of your brand, and then you want to bring it to life in a space. Can you take us through that process?
So we have designers in-house, and we're a very design-driven organization. I'm a designer myself. So everything we do happens within the walls of Hem. And we try to find ways of being exciting and try to find ways of being unexpected. Because every time we do these pop-ups, you should have a purpose to come there beyond just seeing the product. It should be something that inspires you. We sit down, we look at the space, we look at where we're at. Now for London, for instance, of course, just the nature of the Coal Drops Yard and the brick and the kind of the history inspires us. And for this pop-up, we used industrial shelvings in bright orange that went really well with the brick. And then we have a very centerpiece-ish bar that's designed by a local design duo. And that's something that is important to us, to infuse some element of surprise and something that you could actually come there just to see this creativity. And for the pop-up here in London, we work together with a design studio called Soft Baroque, who are two guys based out of London, or a guy and a girl. And we basically gave them a brief to design a pink bar because we wanted something to go with the very bright orange shelving and the bright orange wall we have. And then we felt that a pink bar would be a suitable contrast. And then they were given free hands to the design something. And they came up with an amazing bar, basically built on site, and it's made from jesmonite. So they have this technique that they developed. It's called puffy bricks, they call it. And it's basically balloons, which are then filled with jesmonite, and then it's left to sit. And then you do this, it's hard to describe this in a, without actually looking at pictures. But then you place these next to each other, and then it forms almost like soft bricks. And then it's all painted in pink. It's very striking, and it's something that allows us to be creative beyond the products, which are, you know, mass-produced, and they're going to be adjusted for a certain function. Whereas with the space and with something like this, a commission, we can be completely borderless, which allows us to be exciting.
When you're commissioning something like this, how do you find a balance between making it look brilliant and photogenic and also having that experience of tactileness, of being able to enjoy the space when you're there? How does that process work?
I don't know if we ever thought about it from a picture-first perspective. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should. In this case, it turned out very well with the pink and the blobbiness. But for us, it's so much about the materiality, about the connection with the designers, with allowing them to have a brief that gets them excited. And then we kind of trust them from there. So it's very gut feeling oriented, our strategy. It's not very strategic.
From what I understand, around half of your products make it to the US, is that correct?
Yeah, a bit more, yeah.
So what's happening in the US market, first of all?
Well, the US has a very good trend right now in general. A lot of businesses are opening up new offices. We sell quite a lot of our products to projects where interior designers and architects are designing. So our business is set up to cater to both the professionals and the consumers. But in this case, for the professionals, they design offices for a lot of the tech companies. And many of them are very interested in making environments that attract the right type of talent. So they look for the right furniture, for the right interior elements to kind of get that space that attracts those talents. And we fit into that picture. They want something that is young, that is of quality, that has a lot of connotations. And beyond all, they want quality. They need to have products that last and that kind of have the same value that they try to communicate.
And I know your brand, it's not overtly Scandinavian, but obviously you are based in that region. And it just seems that quite a lot of Danish or Swedish brands seem to do very well in the US. Is there something that resonates over there with Scandinavian design?
Yeah, Scandinavia definitely has a good run. And it had for decades in the US. I think it's more now that the accessibility is there. Before it was more a hassle to get Scandinavian design in the US. And now it's slightly easier. We set up our organization to have a warehouse in the US from day one. So we have been even more accessible than others, maybe. But it fits. It's minimal. It's functioning for offices and for homes. We see a lot of business on the coasts still, but it's happening also more in the cities in central US as well.
You were talking before about tech companies and their desire to have more comfortable, more cozy, more welcoming spaces and furniture. You've recently taken on some capital, and it almost seems kind of like that tech world push of a big injection of money into a company to help it grow quite quickly. How do you kind of see that movement, and what are you going to be using the money for?
Well, we see a lot of opportunity, and it's expensive to start a furniture brand, especially the way we do it. We keep stock of everything to be able to ship fast. So a lot of the money that we now raised will be used to build inventory, to produce more product, to have it on stock, to be more available. But then, of course, we want to do more of these pop-ups. We want to be visible to more audiences. So it's a good time. It seems like there's a new wave of customers that are asking for authenticity, for a brand that actually, you know, is for their generation. All of these design brands that I've grown up with and that I love, they are beautiful, but they're also from a different era. And now there's a need for new brands that speak a language that is more in tune with how people work and live today. So there's an opportunity now, and the market is there. And for us, it's just about capturing it. And we need capital for that.
And your ambitious very ambitious from what I'm reading in terms of comparing your company to IKEA and maybe sitting at a higher level than IKEA in terms of quality and production and things like that. What are you learning from that brand and how are you kind of interpreting that and putting it into your own space?
Well, IKEA is amazing. I mean, they opened the doors for Scandinavian design internationally. I mean, you have demand for Scandinavian design in Asia, in Middle East, everywhere, basically. It's thanks to IKEA. So we owe them a lot. And they also shown that you can build a global brand with Scandinavian design. And that's something that we want to do as well. I think it's definitely doable. There's a market for it. The furniture market is one of the biggest markets in the world. And there are very few global brands. Apart from IKEA, it's hard to name one, actually. So there should be room for a couple of them that is in different price segments. We're a premium brand, including what we offer in terms of quality. And I think there's a lot of people right now that asks for something else, that wants to know where their products are from and wants to know that there's passion put into the products. So it should be possible. And why aim any lower?
And just finally, what would you say the biggest challenges are getting to that point, growing this brand globally? Is it to do with manufacturing? Is it to do with marketing? I mean, what are your biggest concerns right now?
Distribution, I think, operations. It's, as we started out saying, it's the products are quite bulky and you need a lot of product to cater to these markets internationally. The big challenges are actually not what you might think they are in reaching new audiences. It's actually setting up the right type of supply chain and operations.
And you're kind of doing that by yourself. You're not following a traditional model, are you?
Well, we're inspired by how big e-commerce companies act. But we're not doing the traditional route of relying on middlemen, of relying on distributors, etc. So we're trying to build this out ourselves, which is expensive and it's challenging, of course. But that's part of the fun.
That was Patrice Palmer, founder and CEO of Hem, speaking to Monocle's Nolan Giles. And if you're in London, Hem's pop-up in Coaldrops Yard in King's Cross is open until December 31st. Earlier this month, Sweden's new government said it would block plans for a new Apple store in the city's oldest park, the Kungsträdgatan, as I believe it's pronounced. The structure was set to be designed by Foster and Partners and followed the shelving of a David Chipperfield-designed Nobel Centre, also in Stockholm. So what's afoot in the Swedish capital, and why is this Scandi nation opposing these ambitious new buildings? Well, to unpick the issue, I sat down with Monocle 24's executive producer, Tom Edwards, on our daily news show, The Briefing, to discuss the matter in little more detail.
Plenty to talk about here. We've discussed before Apple's bid to sort of position itself and its stores kind of more deeply within city locations around the world. It's welcomed in some places, it's rejected in others. What do you make of this Stockholm chapter of the saga?
Well, I think it's very interesting, and it's a story that has implications beyond simply what Apple are doing, the future of retail and of public space. It's about how we all think about our cities. So the reason that this has caused such a funk is down to local politics. The new Green Alliance Party, as of September, have kicked back against this development in the Kungsträdgatan, which literally means King's Street, kind of overlooking the palace towards Stockholm's old town. And people are a bit upset by the notion that a company like Apple are going to take control of a load of public space. You know, last time I went to Kungsträdgatan, all I saw there, apart from a temporary ice rink which was put up for the winter, was a rather lonely looking TGI Fridays. So it's not in question that the space needs some development. I think it's probably made headlines because it's a Foster and Partners project. There's a little bit of a backlash against us putting all of our hopes in tech companies anyway. But actually what they're trying to do is take a leading role in civic engagement, in re-enlivening spaces in the city. Stockholm, however, as you know, is a society of consensus. And, you know, how we deal with private spaces and public spaces is a matter of fierce public debate. So there's a bit of a kickback. People are worried about what it says about their city that Apple are taking over. But we shouldn't necessarily be surprised by Apple's moves. We spoke to the VP in charge of retail, Angela Arendts. It must have been earlier this year or late last year for Monocle magazine. And she said very plainly, you know, before any of these squares were redeveloped, that she wanted Apple shops to be a space of public discourse, which is a little bit misleading, because unless you're buying a £1,000 phone, I'm sure you'd be turfed out quite quickly. But this is part of their way of dealing with retail and trying to enliven it and get people involved.
Well, let me ask you a bit more about that, because there's obviously a balance to be struck here. And it was telling, even in Stockholm, the city authorities welcomed Apple to the city in broad terms, but said, look, you know, this is in the wrong place and it's the wrong arrangement. I mean, should we be pleased that Apple is seeking to not just put down a sort of a footprint for bricks and mortar, but to really enmesh itself into the sort of urban fabric? You know, we know from, as you mentioned, Angela Arendt, you know, she's talked about Apple looking to the future of how retail works. That's to be commended. Is it as insidious, though, as some suggest? If you think back to in Melbourne, we ran into a similar issue and people were very blunt in a sort of accusing Apple of trying to almost sort of appropriate civic spaces. Presumably the truth, as we would see it, Josh, lies kind of somewhere between those two extremes.
Completely. I mean, it's called, you know, it's called the King Street Garden. This land was all owned by the king, and I don't think anyone wants to go back to an unfair system where a tiny number of very rich people own all the public space. Mm. But we're seeing it reinterpreted and a recalibration of what we expect from these things. So it doesn't belong to the king anymore. It does belong to Apple, or should I say that Apple have the rights to develop it. And they've seen great success in doing it in some places. Milan is a place where a public square has been re-enlivened, not without a little debate, but re-enlivened nonetheless by Apple. As you mentioned, it's not been as warmly received in Melbourne. So there are a lot of political points being won about what this means. But no one's saying Apple doesn't have a right to develop the square. It's just the way in which it's done. If we have time, I can bring in another example of a project.
Please do, Josh.
Also by a British architecture practice within that kind of Starkitect, quote-unquote Starkitect banner, David Chipperfield's redevelopment of the Nobel Prize Museum has also kind of run aground, and an institution called the Beauty Council is very influential in the way that Stockholm City is developed. So it was born out of the fact that the centre of Stockholm, an area called Gamlestan, the old town, just had so many beautiful old buildings, so a society was convened to make sure that new developments were true to the historic colour of the neighbourhood, that they weren't 10 times taller than everything else, that they didn't ruin views. But this organisation, the so-called Beauty Council, has been accused of being very conservative. So, you know, what we have here is not, yes, you know, architects are wrong in redeveloping areas, private companies shouldn't own any public space, but actually that Stockholm is a deliberative society and the way in which it's done needs to be much, much more tactful about what these public spaces mean to people. How do we live better? How can we communicate better, travel faster, cure diseases, or react better to a crisis? These are big questions society often asks itself, and often we look to design to be part of the solution. Coming up with such solutions requires a lot of optimism, energy, and fresh thinking. And every year at Dubai Design Week, which wrapped up over the weekend, some of the world's most inspiring recent design graduates, from the Royal College of Art in London to the Makerere University in Kampala and beyond, congregate to share their ideas. Now in its third year, the graduate show received some 1,000 submissions to take part. Monocle contributor David Michon was at the event and met the grad show curator, Brendan McGettrick, to find out just a little more.
Intentionally, we try to keep it as wide as possible because one of the things that we're trying to do is to express that design is something of, you know, deep personal relevance to essentially everyone. One of the things that's frustrating to me about design as it's perceived is that it's totally, it feels completely irrelevant to like someone like my father, for instance, you know, who doesn't care about fashion, doesn't care about interior design, you know, all these kinds of things. So by stretching the boundaries as wide as possible, we're trying to make the suggestion that actually design, it's ultimately really about looking at the world critically, trying to think of ways that you can intervene that could make a positive, you know, impact. So something like Hackney Repair Archive, which is, yeah, ultimately it's kind of a service design where you're trying to figure out how to, you know, essentially make up for the fact that, you know, there isn't adequate funding to repair public spaces anymore. So then really the thinking behind that is to kind of identify the problem and think of a way to create a system that could sort of make up for the shortfall. Something like that for me is absolutely design, and it's something which is, again, relevant for a much, much wider audience of people who kind of are not like enamored with the complexities of industrial design execution, you know, those kinds of things. That's all valid and interesting too, but really I try to make it as wide as possible for that reason. And then all I would say is, The secondary criteria is, like, as I said, after it being a genuinely new thing, is it trying to do something positive? Because, like, you can also say that, like, you know, is Uber a design or something like that? I would actually say it is a design, but what you get a lot of is really, like, basically meaningless things. Like, you know, it's like, it's Uber, like, it's an app that, you know, brings someone to fold laundry at your house, you know? Like, something like that we'd never have in Global Gratitude because it doesn't, it's not needed, and frankly, it's who cares, basically. So it should be new, and it should be actually trying to do something beneficial that if it were to go into practice would actually try to make an improvement, give people a new ability or make life simpler for people or open up, you know, some new thinking.
And then for you is, you know, obviously it's called a Global Gratitude because there are students from all over the world, but is that also something that you hope these projects address, a need that is kind of very human and not necessarily kind of tethered to a particular location or place?
Yeah, well, no, it to a certain extent, as in terms of the totality of the show, yeah, I would say it's interesting to me that it's trying to reveal how things which seem very specific are kind of like, in a way, universal. What I think is kind of interesting in making the show, and I've learned this through making it, I wouldn't say that I started out with this feeling, is that ultimately there's just some very, very basic universal concerns that everybody deals with differently based on the cultural context and economic context and everything. But they're ultimately, you know, we want to find love, we want to have a family. When we have a family, we'd like them to be educated, you know, we'd like to stay healthy. We want to work, but we also want to have some sort of sense of dignity in our work. And all of these kinds of things are, again, totally universal, timeless concerns. And then what's interesting is that some of the hyper-specific responses to those kind of illuminate a much larger kind of understanding of what's going on. So, like, there are projects, you know, that some of my favorite projects this year are like this backpack, which is designed for porters in the Indian rail system. So they're carrying, I think he said something like 40 kilos on their head, and, you know, suitcases and things like that. So anyways, he's designed a backpack which redistributes the weight so that there's less pressure on the spine. So that's a hyper specific thing, but it does make you think so much about all of the sort of people whose entire existence is based on their physical ability to carry things, to move things, etc. How can you, and the fact that because often that's, they're occupying the lowest sort of strata of society, how little thought to kind of making minor improvements to make their lives better, their health better, actually happens. So, like I say, it's the idea, a kind of universal idea of trying to empower people, trying to make work better for people, trying to kind of continue the evolution of making manual labor more humane. That's a thing which I think is not specific, but it's somehow, for me at least, easier to start thinking about it if I look at something hyper-specific. And some of these projects which are so, or like the project which is helping, you know, milk farmers in the Andes, like, bring their milk to market, or, you know, not something I'd spend a lot of time thinking about previously, but it's kind of, you immediately get it, and you realize that that's like a tiny little pixel of a much, much bigger tableau that we should be thinking about, and that design could, like, really actively play a role in helping.
Just because of the kind of diversity of universities and institutions involved, it's quite a good barometer for just the state of design education or kind of trends in design education. What, from your perspective, do you kind of learn about education through seeing the results of it?
Yeah, you can definitely see, like, schools of thought, like pedagogical schools of thought. Some are very, very research intensive and very field work intensive. And then the project, like, you can tell that probably 80% of the time went into defining the problem, figuring out who your user group is, and then you make the project. Some are, you know, still very, very craft based, and it's all about the beauty of the object and the sort of skillful execution of the object. What I would say is, what I think is the issue that's come up in my experience related to education is that there's a really problematic and ultimately, in my opinion, unfair pressure that's on schools right now, because the reality is that what you're trying to provide them is a design education. So what you're trying to do is produce a competent designer. The problem is that the way the world works now and the way the economy works now is that actually you're expected when you graduate to essentially be an entrepreneur, to know how to start a business, to know how to produce things, to know how to market yourself, to know how to interact with this whole sort of extremely complex system that sort of you're at the center of when you are trying to have your own office or you're trying to bring anything into the world. And I don't think with some very few exceptions, there's like adequate training for that. So why I think that's unfair is I don't think that's actually their responsibility, because they're design schools and what they should be doing is creating designers. Unfortunately though, I really know from making the show that, like, for the press and stuff, there's so many schools that simply have no consideration of press built into their curriculum or built into their organization at all. So then you get into a situation where someone has a really brilliant project, they don't have nice images for it, they don't have any way to really get it any attention, and so you get this the rich get richer scenario where, like, big schools that know how to do this get lots of attention. So it's, yeah, for me it's a tricky thing, because partly the show exists to try to respond to that and open up opportunities for other schools, but I definitely do see that the nature of the hyper-competitive sort of environment that we're in means that you're at a disadvantage if you don't already know how to operate in it. And without providing that as a part of the education, I think it's, you certainly shouldn't expect anyone to have it. I mean, it's like they always say, like, you know, you learn to do calculus in high school or whatever, but you don't learn how to, like, pay taxes and things like that. And you wonder, like, at a certain point, wouldn't it be better to just teach people how to pay their taxes? So there's an element of that where maybe it's practical and maybe it's boring, and maybe it feels like you're just sort of giving in to the free market and letting the market dictate too much of what goes on in a school. And I actually have total sympathy for that, because I do think that the education should be a sort of bubble that has alternate value system. The problem is when you leave that bubble, the other value system doesn't have any sympathy for it. So it's,
and then it's like a halfway house for design
yeah,
students.
That's a good idea. A halfway house for journalists. We're talking about design, but frankly, it's an aspect that touches almost all fields.
Our sincere thanks to Monocle's David Michon there, speaking to the curator of the Global Grad Show at Dubai Design Week, Brendan McGettrick. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Don't forget, if you need more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast On Design Extra. You can listen on monocle.com/radio live, and that show airs on Thursdays, or you can download them at a time that suits you, wherever you find your podcasts. You could also pick up the latest issue of Monocle magazine, one of our many seasonal newspapers, or the libraries of books that keep us busy during the day producing. Monocle on Design itself was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.